Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you remember the first time you heard someone ask, "So, what's the takeaway?" And then suddenly, the phrase seemed to be everywhere. It's just one of the buzzwords Diana Seneschal addresses in her new collection of essays called Mind Over Memes, Passive Listening, Toxic Talk, and Other Modern Language Follies. Her book is published by Roman and Littlefield and brings Diana Seneschal to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
And the takeaway is the first meme that you address. How is a takeaway different from, let's say, a synopsis or just an understanding?
Well, the way that the word takeaway is used today suggests an impatience for reduction, that people want right away before hearing something out, before actually learning what something is, they already want to be able to sum it up. And so the problem with the takeaway, as I see it, is that it sidesteps or jumps over the actual understanding of the thing. So people will ask, well, what's the takeaway? Mm-hmm. And as though that were the goal, to come at that thing that they could then easily say, easily remember, and use to stand for what it was they heard, whether it was a song or a lecture or a play. They've got that takeaway. It becomes like a tourist trinket, in a sense.
We recently did a show about cause and effect, how people explain the problem with a simple answer. Oh, the reason that we had the recession was because of a housing bubble. And to some degree, the takeaway is the same sort of thing.
It's a similar matter. The takeaway is something that explains things very easily to people, tells people what something is about, when in fact the thing that the takeaway represents is more complex.
You're an educator. How are takeaways used in education these days?
In different ways and in different countries. But in the United States, often the teachers are required or expected to put an aim on the board, and that can take different forms. But often they're supposed to tell the students exactly what they will be getting out of the lesson. And it's good to be clear about what the lesson will contain, and it's good to tell students where things are going and what they will be learning, but not necessarily so good to tell them exactly what they will get out of the lesson, because if the lesson is worth its salt, if it's worth anything at all, there will be more that they get out of it than is even expected in the moment. They're studying a poem. There will be more that comes out of the discussions and more that even the teacher finds in the poem than she or he expected.
Do we know when the takeaway first came into the language?
So it seems to, in Britain, it meant something different and still does. It means take out food from a restaurant.
Yes, well.
And so I believe that it has come into frequent usage in the past few decades. I believe that it goes back to, in its current usage, goes back as far as the 70s, but it has become more and more frequent in its use.
You quote George Orwell's warnings in his essay, Politics and the English Language, in which he warned that the slovenliness of our language makes it easier to have foolish thoughts. And that's to some degree what this book is about.
That if we do not question the language, and questioning the language doesn't mean being finicky about grammar or hesitating before every word that we say, but if we don't think about the ideas that we carry into our words, then the ideas themselves will get messy.
But if Orwell was writing about this, what, in the 50s or so, that means that what you're writing about has been with us for quite a while.
It's an endless problem. It's been with us since ancient times, and part of the purpose of literature, or not purpose, but part of the role of literature is to get us to hear language in a different way.
Do you think his warning speaks to our current political climate, like phrases like national emergency?
Without a doubt, yes.
Did you appreciate Jeff Bezos' use of the word complexifier recently?
I didn't see that, I'm sorry. But yes, I would have laughed.
You've taught in Istanbul, and most recently at the Varga Katalin Gymnasium in Szolnok, Hungary. I hope I pronounced those words correctly. What happens to language in a state that's becoming more and more authoritarian? How does it move us toward authoritarianism?
The problem with Hungary is that it goes beyond any takeaways about it. So the political system is moving toward authoritarianism, and Viktor Orban, the prime minister, is explicit about this. This is not an interpretation. He talks about illiberal democracy. So this is true, but then there are many other layers to Hungary and many other things going on. And what people do not realize who rely only on the news about Hungary is that it's a profoundly reflective place, and people are grappling with all kinds of questions and with language. So I've found myself in the midst of inspiring and rich discussions day after day about the words we use with my students and with colleagues and with other people.
You don't face hostility because of the fact that you're American? And I mean, they're going after George Soros right now because he's Jewish.
Orban has been publishing anti-Soros propaganda. This is not in any way representative of what the people feel whom I see in my everyday life. And to the contrary, I find around me a thirst for contact with people from other cultures and a great desire for conversation. And not only that, but in my students' words in the classroom, there's such a level of both curiosity and sophistication that when we talk about the news and when we talk about literature and we talk about a range of events, the insights that they bring to the table are so much more than I myself expected or had considered. So there's a richness there that doesn't get the credit that it deserves.
Because they're living in the midst of a situation that's kind of turmoil.
It's a changing state. So Hungary is going through big changes. And I think what people are trying to figure out and are wrestling with day after day is what's coming now and how to form the government that people want and what's going to look like in the future. And people are talking about this and thinking about this. And I think the young people have ideas that are going to change what Hungary looks like in the next 10 or 20 years.
Do you see this book, Mind Over Memes, as a continuation of your last book, The Republic of Noise?
Yes, because Republic of Noise, it was a book about solitude, but not necessarily solitude of going out into the countryside and being alone, though that as well. But
and you really, do write about solitude in this book as well.
As well, yes. But solitude of being able to step apart from the crowd and think on your own, although we never think completely on our own, that's impossible, but to think somewhat on your own and not to rely on trends and not to follow blindly what other people are doing and the way others are thinking. And that was how I framed and considered solitude in that book. And this book is really an extension of that because it's about thinking about the words we use.
What are your thoughts about internet speech? People use LOL to indicate a good laugh, OMG to express shock. They use a letter U for the word U, the number two for all of the different spellings of the word two. And then there are emojis. How do they impact our thinking? They're all shortcuts.
They're shortcuts and a form of subtle corruption. And I speak for myself because I wouldn't ask how other people are using it, but whenever I use a like or an emoji, I have a subtle, small sense of self-betrayal because never is the like a real expression of what I think about something. I may love it, but then a heart also wouldn't do. Or I may like it in certain ways and not in others, or I may have been interested in it in a particular way. And there's a kind of, it lets a person escape saying what he or she means about something.
Also, the like sometimes is a way of telling the person who has written the thing that we like them. We're paying attention. We heard this thing. We read this thing.
Yes, and that's a problem.
That's not the same thing as saying I actually liked it all.
That's true. And often it is a gesture of approval or a gesture of support, and it doesn't necessarily have much to do with the work itself.
Isn't the word meme a meme invented by Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene, to describe the transmission of an idea?
Yes, and it has a positive connotation in that sense as well, in that certain kinds of transmission are necessary to a culture, that certain ideas and whole bundles of ideas must be transmitted in a way that's semi-automatic for a culture to survive. And then once in a while, you have something that comes along and questions it and doesn't transmit it automatically, but that the two things are necessary for the propagation of culture. So the way that Dawkins uses meme is complex and multifaceted, and it itself has been reduced when we talk about internet memes. Now, about internet memes, this book clearly is not about them, but they have their pros and their cons. They can be funny. They can be different, interesting, but they also have, for me, that reductive side that this is all I have to say. Here you go. Here's a picture. Here are a few words. And sometimes the effect is also damaging. Memes can be cruel. Mm-hmm. They can be a way of hurting a person online, publicly, embarrassing and shaming and so forth.
And there's been a wide range of the use of the word covers a wide range of things, as you point out, both positive and negative.
Yes.
I just keep on seeing the word meme attached to different things and thinking, couldn't we have used another word there? Another word that I've been hearing lately, or one of the memes, is what are the optics of a particular situation? You don't cover that in this book, but that's another shortcut.
Yes, because optics, it's an ambiguous word. And to me, when I think of optics, I think of the science of sight and seeing, mm-hmm. and how we explain the way that images appear to us, and how we explain how sight happens and how picturing, imaging happens. But the optics of a situation, that could mean so many things that to use it without clarification could lead to some muddles.
They usually mean this thing isn't looking as good as it could. But aren't cliches useful at times?
There are shortcuts in language that are useful. And yes, cliches, colloquial expressions, because of their commonality and efficiency, they are useful. But it is also useful to question them and to keep speech alive. And much of this depends on what kind of speech we're talking about. For sometimes you need the shorter expression or the more familiar expression just to move through a situation easily. And then at other times, you need something fresher and clearer.
Sometimes they sound a little clumsy to me, like pocketable answer, which is a variation on the word takeaway. What's the pocketable answer to that?
The pocketable answer, well, I used that phrase because I was thinking about how people want a product out of any experience, and the takeaway is in a sense a product. You know, people like to come out of a lecture or a concert or a play knowing what they got, mm-hmm. and that's the pocketable thing. But that's often an illusion because it's not the whole of what they received.
Well, sometimes it's more fun to have an open-ended conversation, yeah. after you've seen a lecture or a concert or whatever,
yes.
than say, so what was that all about?
Well, the problem is yes, it's an open-ended conversation, yes, and then back to the...
Inspired by, and so you can go even further than the lecture went.
Yes, indeed, to take it and then talk about it further and see where the conversation goes, and to do the same thing with your thoughts. And it's not necessary always to say what you thought about something immediately afterward. There's value to carrying it in your mind for a while.
You say that comments and reviews can be a part of what you call the takeaway culture.
This is in line with precisely that often you go to a concert and then immediately afterward or the next day you get an email saying, tell us what you thought of it, complete this short survey, and you have to rate it and rate various aspects of it. And it not only shortchanges the experience, but it can also shortchange the memory, that after filling out a survey like that, you aren't remembering it in its fullness anymore.
I feel bombarded by surveys now from all sorts of different sources. I just got one from Google asking me whether Google is useful. What am I supposed to say? Yeah, no, whatever. I'm speaking to Diana Seneschal. Her book is Mind Over Memes, Passive Listening, Toxic Talk, and Other Modern Language Follies. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York. You did a TED Talk, but you're not a fan of TED Talks.
No, I'm not. And it was a TEDx talk, just to be clear. But I don't think that I would be invited to speak on TED, although that's I'm possibly wrong. I'm not a fan of TED Talks. And when I was invited, I said yes on the condition that I could subtly make fun of TED while I was speaking, or the part of the point of the speech would be subtly to make fun of TED. And so it was called Take Away the Takeaway, and it was about the takeaway. And of course, TED Talks, many of them, not all, there are some beautiful TED Talks, and I don't want to generalize about them all, but many TED Talks are about the takeaway. They're focused on giving you something that you can do right away to improve your life, or that the world can do right away to improve the world.
You say to sell concepts.
Yes.
So a TED Talk, at least those, is different from a lecture?
Yes, because a lecture unravels and explores a subject and shows the complexities in it and takes us to a different level of thinking about it. And the TED Talk presents some little nugget of knowledge, something interesting, something to catch people's attention, and then makes it immediately relatable to them, showing how they could implement it. And it leaves people with a cheery feeling, but there's some illusion and delusion there.
Why do you think TED Talks have become so popular and respected? I often receive something where the CV includes the fact that this person gave TED Talk.
TED Talks are immensely popular because for different reasons. And to give them credit, they are a nice way to learn about different subjects in a short time. And if you're tired and you don't have much time to read extensively on the subject, you can relax and listen to a TED Talk and learn a little something. So that they have that going for them. But they've grown so much in glamour that the TED Talk can be a ticket immediately to a book contract and to all kinds of other things. And so people are looking at the TED Talk now not only for its content, but for the status symbol that it is.
And the person giving the TED Talk is assumed to be the ultimate expert on this subject. So anything that he or she says is to be taken totally seriously.
Yes, you get crowned with expertise when you give the TED Talk.
So what happened? What was the response to your TED Talk?
Positive. People enjoyed it. It was a small, not an enormous room, but it was full and people laughed at the jokes. It's fun when that happens.
I'm going to move on to another subject that you discuss in the book, teamwork. How is a team of football players different, let's say, from a team of teachers?
The football team is a team in that it has a specific concrete goal, and all the players are there to help achieve that goal together. Scoring points. And then there are other aspects of the game too. There's beauty in the very strategy and in the playing, and you can watch football for its beauty, and many people do. But the beauty is less important than winning. If you don't win, then you haven't done what you're supposed to do. Teachers are also there to win in a certain sense, but the work of a teacher is not only to achieve, say, test scores for the students or to get them to do well on tests, but to open them to subjects and get them to think about things. And much of this involves solitary work. So to talk about teachers as a team is to distort the nature of the work.
But when you have faculty meetings, does the word team get invoked a lot?
A lot, yes. Now, but
and what do you think that's how do you think that's changed education?
in many ways. Well, the word team is now applied to everything. It's not just education. But when it is applied to education, the implication is sometimes, not always, that speaking out and thinking differently are no longer valued, that what is valued is just cooperating and doing the work in front of us and in fact doing the opposite of standing out or sticking out, being more like everybody else.
In the book you say teamwork always connotes compulsion and conformity.
It does connote that, and it doesn't mean that it always involves that, but it does connote it.
So why do you think the insistence on teamwork has taken such a hold on our culture?
It's a kind of corporate collectivism. So I believe that people who live in post-communist countries would be much more hesitant to use that word for everything because they're distrustful of the imposed collective, the imposed group. Whereas here, there's a naive enthusiasm that hasn't run its full course yet. There's an idea that it's great to be on a team. It's great to be part of something bigger. And the enthusiasm has a basis. It is exciting to be part of a team. But people adopting that word don't always see the flip side or the darker side of the team, which is that it can squelch not only individuality, but things that need to be said.
But what about an orchestra, for example? Isn't an orchestra a team? Because don't orchestras also have shared goals?
Orchestra have shared goals, but they can't specify them. When you give a concert, you're accomplishing something that goes beyond anything that you say you're going to do. I mean, the things that you can specify would be at the very lowest level of what you plan to do. You hope that everybody plays in tune and in rhythm and following the conductor's general motions and directives, but that's the bottom level. What happens in a concert is that plus, and it's those other things that really cannot be described by teamwork. When you have a beautiful concert, you don't want to say, well, thanks to the team. You want to say something else. You want to turn your attention to the music, and the music goes beyond the things that you can pinpoint.
So do teams tend to suppress the individual, suppress the nonconformist? Is that one of the intentions of teams?
I don't know about the intentions, but often it is the effect of teams, but not necessarily. People in management, organizational management, are aware of the problem of teams, their capacity for suppressing the individual, and they are working hard to reform or to think of the team in a different way. But there is, many people have written about the tendency of teams to rush a decision or to push aside dissent and to view dissent as unteam-like and uncooperative, when in fact the dissent can help inform the decisions and enrich the work.
Because it gives us other things to consider.
Yes.
Rather than the obvious. But is it different than collaboration? The staff of my show, for example, we share certain concepts about what the show should be like, but I appreciate when a staff member comes up with an approach that wouldn't have occurred to me. But I still think of them as a team on some level.
A team in the sense that that you are working together, mm-hmm, to create the program.
We have a shared goal, is to do the best radio shows we can do. Sometimes we actually succeed.
And I would say that's an understatement. It's a terrific.
I wasn't fishing for a compliment there.
Some people use the word team in a much more flexible way, making allowances for the different ideas that people bring to the table. And my point is not that all teams are terrible, that all teams are repressive, or that even that the use of the word team is wrong. But what I've seen is that the word team has taken over so many associations. And what happens as a result is that people lose track of the kinds of associations that are possible. People think that everything has to be a team, but there are so many other forms of collaboration and partnership, working together, friendship, collegial relationships that need room as well and need expression.
You argue for what you call a good misfit, but don't most people considered misfits wish that they weren't?
Up to a point, until maybe it comes...
Some people are proud of being outsiders.
I think that I'm thinking of people I've known and colleagues and students and friends and different people, and that there is a point of reconciling opposites where you are happy about being a misfit in certain ways and then you suffer from it in other ways. And those two things are both true at once. And so you wouldn't, if pressed, you wouldn't want to change this, but you would wish for a little bit more understanding from others. And I can't, that's a generalization, but the feelings about being a misfit are complex and sometimes contradictory, but so is the misfit status. It doesn't come in just one form. And you can be a misfit and nobody knows that you are. You can look as though you fit in and you're like other people, but you can carry something that's different.
Although sometimes it gets a little more complicated. I remember way back when I was in college, and one of the philosophy teachers was pushed out because the new chair of the department was a member of a certain philosophical school, actually. In this case, it was an admirer of Ayn Rand. And so all of the philosophy teachers at Brooklyn College at that moment were in agreement. And that kind of frightened me because I thought the whole concept of college was that you got a wide range of ideas, even in one department.
Yes, and that, for many people, that has stopped being the goal, that the people, there has been a trend in colleges, at least in the United States, but possibly elsewhere as well, toward seeking comfort and safety, and with that, unfortunately, comes conformity.
How has that trend moved into corporate hiring?
That corporate hires often use personnel, corporate managers often use personality tests to tell whether a person would be a good fit for a job. And the personality tests are structured in such a way as to identify people who think differently, or people who may not get along smoothly with everybody, or people who may question company policy a lot. And so they may, before even reaching the interview stage, that people may be weeded out on account of their unconventional ideas or ways of thinking.
And you write about the misfit theory. Why might it be valuable?
So there is something called misfit theory, which is slowly gaining traction, which is the observation that, for instance, immigrants and people who have come in from the outside have had to use a great deal of ingenuity to make their way in the world, and then that ingenuity would then become something prized by the society, and it would enrich their lives and the lives of others. And so that the misfit has a role, not only a role in society, but as a leader in a certain sense. And this is becoming more popular, but it isn't being applied as flexibly and as widely as it should be, because there are many different ways of being a misfit, but not just being a misfit, thinking in a different way from other people about what you are doing and thereby enriching your surroundings.
So when we have restrictive immigration laws or built walls, are we weeding out all of the misfits, the potential misfits? Or some of them, anyway.
We have no idea whom we're weeding out. That's the problem.
Because I remember, but one of the wonderful moments in American history was after World War II, or in the years, whatever those years, when all of these intellectuals came from Europe and brought all sorts of ideas that were not part of the American sensibility, and changed the way that we thought about things. They changed the movies. They changed pretty much everything.
Yes, and we don't know what we're leaving out and shutting out today, but there's a great danger that we're shutting out much more than we can even measure and imagine right now.
You've called one of your essays "The Toxicity of Toxic." Isn't the word toxic being used to describe a wide range of things these days?
Yes, and it's often used to describe people, and there are many books and articles about how to get toxic people out of your life. And this is dangerous because it falls in line with scapegoating that has existed through the ages, through history. Societies use scapegoats to supposedly purify themselves, to get rid of problems. But now it's being used on a personal level. The idea of many of the books, self-help books about getting rid of toxic people, is that if you just get rid of those people, then those people, and we're not talking about toxic influences, toxic situations, that makes a little bit more sense. But when you call a person toxic, you're buying into the delusion that if you somehow cleanse yourself of imperfect or difficult people, inconvenient people, you will soar towards success. And you yourself, of course, are pure. It's these other people who are the problem. And so it's a matter of placing the problem on others, treating others as the problem, and believing somehow that your happiness and success are in your hands.
This is, it's a metaphor. Isn't it open to many different interpretations?
Yes, it is. But the problem is with the widespread use and careless use, that all of the words in the book can be used. This is not a do not use book. It's not a usage. It's not these words are bad type of book. It's a book that is aimed at getting people to think about certain words, and toxic is one of them.
What words would you prefer to use instead of toxic?
Perhaps a suffering person. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a person with some difficult traits. There are people with difficult traits who are nonetheless important to the world in which we live.
So it would lead us to be a little more charitable toward others.
More charitable and more attentive to the whole. So there are people who can be very difficult, stubborn, argumentative, even hurtful in some ways, and who yet have great gifts. And this does not mean that we should set ourselves up for being abused day after day. That's not the point at all. But there are many levels and ranges of difficulty, and all of us have difficulty in ourselves. And if we try to pretend otherwise, we're actually not letting ourselves exist fully. To have an idea, to have a strong idea, to have a strong character, you probably must be difficult to some, and probably not everybody's going to like you.
There are other kinds of toxicity. Climate change, for example, is producing a real toxicity.
Yes.
So to some degree, if we use toxic to cover pretty much everything, we're actually weakening the use of it when it really applies?
Yes, absolutely. When we use it in the wrong places, then we are not allowing ourselves to use it in an important and strong way.
You have an essay in this book titled Change, Our False God, and in it you talk about the rhetoric of reform. What are the popular cliches about change?
Well, that people don't like change, which is often true, that the world can be divided into two groups, the change agents, those heroic people who are working for change, and the change resistors, the defenders of the status quo who are opposing change. And that's a simplistic reduction of human nature and of social forces, because changes come in many different forms, and some are good and some are bad. And just because something is in the air, because a change is underway, does not mean that it's all good and that we should be embracing it. And nor can the world be divided into the change defenders, the change agents, and the change resistors, because the resistors sometimes, as we've already discussed, the resistors may have something to say that can actually make the change better, more effective, more intelligent.
Is it wrong to say that change is inevitable? Because I have to tell you that believing that might have prepared me for a few of the shocks that I've experienced recently in my life.
So here's an analogy. So my students in the ninth grade, some of them are putting on a production of Ionesco's Rhinoceros. And it's great fun, and they're doing a beautiful job with it, and they will be performing it at an English language festival in May. In this play, people one by one start turning into rhinoceroses until there's one human being left. And the problem is that as more and more start turning into rhinoceroses, they also start to justify this phenomenon in their language, in their speech. They start to say, well, the rhinoceroses aren't so bad after all. They're beautiful, actually. It's actually human nature that's the problem. And if we could just go back to real primal nature, we would be the way we're supposed to be. And Ionesco had something specific in mind, and he was thinking of fascism, but this applies to so many situations where people, just because something is happening, just because it's a friend, they think that they must, they're not a friend, a trend, they think something is a trend, they must therefore jump on the bandwagon and justify the trend and talk about it with unremitting praise.
some of the other phrases that really resonated with me that you address, implicit bias, for example.
Yes.
You include a very personal essay on listening. Don't most people know how to listen?
Yes, but listening is often described, unfortunately, as a passive activity. And so first, to be clear, if you enter my classroom, you will not see me lecturing for even half of the lesson. I combine instruction with a lot of discussion. But
which is called interactive learning?
It could be called interactive learning, but the problem is that in many schools, especially in the United States, teachers have been told to keep their talk to a minimum and have the students in group work doing lots of things and talking as much as possible. And that listening, they say, avoid passive listening, instead foster active learning. And I question that opposition, because I'm not suggesting that the whole time should be spent in lectures or that students should be listening to hours of lectures every day. But listening is not passive. Listening, it takes a lot of dedication and attention and thinking and concentration and many complex mental processes.
And you write about, as an adult, you learn to listen to Hebrew cantillation in a synagogue. How is that a different kind of listening?
So it's similar in some ways, in that with this kind of listening, as with other kinds, you are taking in a stream of sounds and a stream of words and assembling them in your mind into a whole. But in the Jewish tradition, there is a cantillation, which is a melodic chanting of the text, and the melody is logogenic, which means that it is derived from the actual structure of the verses, from the grammar of the verses, so that these melodies, this trope, assists the listener in understanding the verse, because the listener can detect when the verse has reached its middle, when certain turns in the phrase happen, and so forth. And so the astute listener can use this to understand the text more clearly. But the person preparing to chant the text in this manner is also studying it in a special way and coming to new understandings of the meaning through this, through the melody.
One of the my favorite topics that you addressed is the use of the phrase, research has shown. What do people automatically believe research summarizes?
Well, there's a great adulation of science, whatever form it may take. And that's social science and the physical sciences and the chemical science, but today often social science. And if people hear that a study has shown something, they often take that as proof that it's simply true. And the thing is that science is investigative. It doesn't arrive at answers. It keeps on turning up new questions. And almost always, conclusions of studies, while often, sometimes they can be very strong, they still retain a tiny amount of uncertainty. And so in that case, the problem with research has shown is that it takes an uncertainty and substitutes a certainty for it. So people come out believing that this is actually, that a study has proved something beyond all doubt, when in fact there's a lot of doubt.
And so that just becomes received truth.
It becomes.
Research has shown that whatever, I'm not going to make up something right now, okay, that brushing your teeth every day is a good idea?
That's, yes, or that Facebook makes people happier, or whatever the study may show, or that chocolate gives you more creative ideas. The problem is that some science is rigorous and some studies are very well founded and well designed and the conclusions are carefully drawn, and others are a little bit less rigorous.
And you write about the lemon introvert test. Why was it wrong, and how did journalists advance the misinterpretation?
Well, the lemon introvert test was performed on people who had been previously tested for their introversion and extroversion, and a correlation was found between people's level of extroversion and their amount of salivation in response to increase of salivation in response to lemon juice being put on their tongue. And the thing is, the original.
How did anybody come up even with thinking about that as a test?
Well, there were actually serious reasons for it, which was a theory that introversion was associated with greater sensitivity to stimuli. Mm. And that makes sense in that you think of introverts not liking noisy environments, whereas extroverts not being bothered by them at all. So lemon being a extremely strong flavor might induce a stronger reaction in introverts. And the thing is that the researchers did not publish the raw data, so it's hard to see what was actually going on, did seem to show a general correlation between introversion and increased salivation. But the problem there is that then the press went and got carried away with this and said, you can find out if you're an introvert by doing the lemon test at home. And there are many problems with that. Yeah. That's first of all, just knowing in advance that you're going to perform a lemon test to find out how introverted you are sets up the experiment for all kinds of bias and error. But in addition, this was never meant to point to conclusions about the individual. We salivate for all kinds of reasons, and the results of a lemon test may vary widely, regardless of our introversion or extroversion.
Or the way we physically react to yes. acidic things.
Yes.
Then there's the 10,000 hours theory that Malcolm Gladwell popularized in his book, Outliers. Where did he get it wrong?
So this theory originated with a serious research study of musicians and observing the relationship between systematic practice and performance. And here the conclusions were generally that those who performed better at the professional level and amateurs as well were tended to be the ones who had not only practiced more hours a day, but who had more systematic practice habits and who made the better use of their free time and who really understood how much free time they had and planned their days well. And also those who filled their free time with other music-related activities. So they weren't, they might go to concerts, so they might listen to music, or they might do other things related to music. And so this makes a lot of sense, and it makes a lot of sense that people become better with practice, and also that to become really good at something, you need a certain amount of practice and a certain amount of time over the years. All of that made sense. The problem lay with the idea that 10,000 hours was somehow the magic number. And not only that, out of this, in relation to this, emerged the idea that's very popular in schools today, the idea of grit. And grit is also an honorable idea, the idea that the people who do well in school are the ones who can stick it out and persist through difficulty and find ways of solving problems. And all of this is valuable. But then schools have turned to measuring grit and trying to encourage grit for its own sake. And it doesn't work like that.
And then there's the implicit association test.
Yes.
So all of these things are meant to research who we really are and then put us along some kind of spectrum?
Well, the implicit association test, as it is being conducted right now online, involves keyboard clicks. And so, for instance, it will give you a series of different photographs and you and different adjectives that may be positive or negative, and you click in order to associate something, give something a positive or a negative association, and I'm not explaining this very well, but the test is supposed to determine whether you have an automatic preference or an automatic association of positive things with black people or white people or old people and young people. There are different categories. But the problem is that when you're giving a test like this, measuring people's instinctive attitudes through keyboard clicks, there's so much imprecision that can enter in. And there's so much that it has been found that the test-retest relation is very unstable. So a person could test one way one time and another way another time. And that the doubts are growing that the tests really tell people anything about what's going on inside them.
So what kinds of questions should a thoughtful person ask when someone tells them research is shown? Should their first instinct be to be a little skeptical?
they should ask for information, which is, first of all, what research is this? Instead of ever accepting the statement research has shown, they should ask which study, performed by whom, under what conditions, and what was the study seeking to find out? What kind of doubts and uncertainties did the authors of the study bring up? How does the summary of the study, the abstract, relate to or differ from the longer explanation of the study? What is the relation between the abstract and the way that the study has been popularized in the press? And what questions remain open even after the study? And this is not to, the point of this is not to cast doubt on all scientific studies or to treat them as all alike. They vary widely in quality, but to remember that good questioning is integral to science and not its enemy.
We don't have much time left, but you also address the fact that there are four types of justice. You want us to give us the takeaway on that?
So, in naming four types of justice, I run into that. I run the risk of a takeaway because there are more, or maybe there are fewer, or maybe the types of justice overlap. But the point of this was that there are different levels of dealing with people working together and viewing each other and relating to each other, and we must be aware of those different levels. So justice can exist inside the person.
Internal justice.
Internal justice. And I called it individual justice simply because internal justice sounded like something bureaucratic, the Department of Internal Justice, and something about that just felt wrong. So but individual justice is when you're regulating the different parts of yourself, you know, and you're trying to, for example, figure out how angry to get about something, or when to give in to a desire to sleep, or when to pull back from others and spend some time alone, and things like that. And you're really working with different parts of yourself. And then there's the justice between two people. And that's really about treating the other person as a full person with respect. And then comes the thing that people call social justice, which is the justice accorded to a group of people. But social justice has a much richer meaning than that, and I didn't intend to reduce it, but only to point out that it exists in relation to other justices. And then finally, public justice, where all the ideas and all the groups and the individuals come together to work out a problem or to discuss ideas.
When Martin Luther King Jr. calls for justice, what kind of justice is he talking about? Is that public justice or?
All the richness of Martin Luther King Jr. is that he addresses all of them at once. And if you read his speeches and if you read his essays, you see them present, every single one of them. You see that he, for instance, in his I Have a Dream speech, which some of my students listened to recently, he talks about resisting the urge toward revenge, maintaining one's own dignity, even in times of anger, and yet at the same time rejecting, by the same token, rejecting the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. So that's talking not only about a group response, but an individual regulation as well. And he's very aware, you know, as he understood that to carry out important lasting social change, one had to be introspective, and one had to live and to act and to speak with integrity and to treat others kindly and respectfully.
Do the social media like Twitter contribute to public justice?
I would say that they take away from public justice because they encourage quick judgments of others and name calling, and I think that it has gotten out of hand and that something is needed to counterbalance that.
Diana Seneschal's book is called Mind Over Memes, Passive Listening, Toxic Talk, and Other Modern Language Follies, published by Roman and Littlefield. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Diana Seneschal, to Jessica Brockington, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Modern Low Paid at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to the Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site. which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.